Okay. Welcome back. This is basically the second week of the course. The reason that we have two sessions today is that we don't have any session on 4th of November. So no exercise session, no lecture session, but today a double session. So last week or last session, we talked about the overview, motivation, why are we doing that stuff. We talked about TLS and the double ratchet, and very briefly only to get a motivation why looking at smaller building blocks is relevant. And if you remember, in provable security, it is important to first of all specify your goals. Then it is important to specify your object, your construction. Then the next step is to specify the assumptions. And when you look at TLS and the double ratchet, you will identify a couple of assumptions. You will identify a couple of building blocks. So, for example, the discrete logarithm is related to the Diffie-Hellman key exchange. And typically, when you analyze the double ratchet or a TLS, you will have the assumption that the discrete logarithm, or you will have to rely on the assumption that the discrete logarithm is hard to break. And you will also have the assumptions that a couple of smaller building blocks, like key derivation functions or ciphers, symmetric encryption schemes, that they offer security. And for that, we first have to define and understand what are these smaller building blocks? How can we specify for these smaller building blocks security? Today, we look at two very fundamental small building blocks: hash functions and key derivation functions. The first building block that we look at today are hash functions. Hash functions are considered in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 168 and following, and in the Christoph Paar and others book on pages 335. As you can imagine, those page numbers are pretty high, and so if you want to really deeply dive into hash functions, you need a couple of underlying concepts. For us in this course, it is sufficient to have a somewhat abstract perspective of hash functions. We do not introduce formal definitions for hash functions, but we will see that this is sufficient. But hash functions are sometimes hard to capture. The interesting part about hash functions is that they typically do not use any key material. So, what is the idea of a hash function? The idea of a hash function is that you basically take an arbitrary long message, so a message m that consists of bits m1 to ml, where l is an arbitrary integer. So for arbitrary L in N, and every bit MI is in the set of zeros and ones, so basically a bit. So a hash function now takes such arbitrary long messages and extracts a short, constant size, constant length value h from that, such that the length of h is n. For some constant n. hash functions are used for all types of different applications, but from my perspective, the most abstract and generic form of what an application could be is that it basically gives a fingerprint for data. So when we looked at how to specify, how to define security, we saw that the most fundamental concept that we have to specify is something like functionality. There is not much functionality to hash functions, but something that is even more fundamental than functionality is the so-called syntax, API or interface. So the syntax, and I will try to be consistent and always specify the syntax of the primitives that we look at. So the syntax of a hash function h is that it takes as input an arbitrarily long bit string, and it outputs a bit string of length n. And now, as I said, we keep the list of properties, including security properties, relatively verbose and abstract. So the properties, first of all, as I said, we want to have arbitrary input length, we want fixed output length, we want that the computation of a hash function is efficient, and this basically holds for all type of algorithms that we consider here in this lecture. And now we come to the primary security guarantees or requirements. So first of all, we want pre-image resistance. And that means, given the output of a hash function h of m, thank you, pre-image resistance. In German, Urbild, Sicherheit, ich weiß gar nicht. I don't know the English translation at the moment, yeah, but pre-image resistance is the term. And that means that given the output of a hash function on input of m, it is hard to find that input. It is hard to find m. The second property that is slightly stronger is second pre-image resistance. And that means, again, given the output of a hash function on input m, it is hard to find a message m prime not equal m, such that the output of the hash function equals on both inputs. The final and most important property that we consider here is so-called collision resistance. And collision resistance means that it is hard to find, I think it's dark enough outside now. M, M prime such that H of M is equal to H of M prime, but M is not equal to M prime. Yes, please. So, it could be given, yes. We could imagine that the adversary who wants to attack that knows the initial M, yes. So it could have as input M and H of M, and it should be hard to output, find another M such that this equals the hash value of M prime, yes. Yeah. Yes, please. Yes. 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 The strongest security requirement, and that's the reason why we only consider that typically, is collision resistance. So if we have collision resistance, then the other properties are basically implied. And that's the reason why you consider here this one the most important one. The interesting part why it is hard to define security for hash functions. Yes, first a question.
What exactly does efficient mean in this context?
Taste. So it depends on your application, on your setting. And this is typically nothing that we specify at least in this course, formally. There is, however, so we will briefly talk about paradigms of defining security, because in order to define some meaningful notion of what it means to have something being hard, that is in principle achievable, you have to separate something that is efficient from something that is not efficient. So for example, finding collisions is in principle possible. Because if you have an arbitrary length input for a hash function, there are always collisions that you can find for a hash function. But first of all, it should take a very long time to find such collisions in comparison to what it takes to evaluate the hash function. And there are classes of computation that we will probably shortly look at, but I don't want to go into the details at the moment. That is okay for you. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is, for collision resistance to formally specify what that means, as I said, it is always possible to find collisions. And when we briefly look ahead, we typically say that for every adversary that is successful in something, we want to build a reduction to break an underlying system. The problem is there could be adversaries that have pre-programmed collisions in them. And so these algorithms, they don't take a long time to find a collision. And from the set of all possible adversaries, there are many, there are infinitely many algorithms that have pre-programmed collisions in them. And for that reason, there are many different ways, but subtly complex ways of defining security for hash functions. And that's the reason why I try to avoid that here and just say that there are ways. We don't look at that here, but if you write your bachelor thesis or master thesis and you have to use hash functions, then you will have to take a look at a certain paper and will understand how to define formally what collision resistance means for hash functions, as long as we don't use key inputs. Once we have keyed inputs, things are different. Okay. A seventh property that I also don't formally specify here is that in principle we want that hash functions have that similar messages should have independent outputs, and more concretely, ideally, the outputs should look random. But all that is again pretty hard to specify if you use a primitive that does not have a secret value as an input. So hash functions don't have keys as inputs. They are just functions, they lay around, you can use them, everybody can use them, and everybody basically has the same hash function. Okay, that's a collection of an abstract perspective of what we want to have from hash functions. And now we look at the first type of construction. And the first type of construction is the so-called Merkel-Damgaard. Construction. Where the second A of Damgaard has this funny circle, this Danish circle. And a very short, very, very interesting anecdote about the Merkel-Damgaard construction is that it is based on two independent developments. So Merkel and Damgaard both came up with this idea, and they both published this idea at the same conference in the same year. So in 1989, both of them published their idea at Crypto. Crypto is the biggest cryptography conference still today. And both of them came up with that same idea. That sometimes happens. So for building the Merkel-Damgaard construction, we first need a building block. So whenever I use these symbols here, this whatever roof thing, I mean that this is just a short interception. And here I want to briefly introduce the building block. And the building block is a so-called compression function. A compression function h prime. And this compression function takes as input strength of length 2n, and an output strings of length n. So graphically, you can think of this as follows. you have two messages, M1 and M2 as inputs, and the output is the hash value such that the length of M1 equals the length of M2, which equals the length of H, which equals N. And such compression functions, they can be built from so-called ideal ciphers. More on that in Katz-Lindell on pages 247 and following. I will not go into the detail of ideal ciphers, but we will look at pseudorandom permutations in 2 weeks, and those are very related to that. So, pseudorandom permutations. Questions? Tut mir leid, dass jetzt dieses Ding hier schon wieder, sorry. Constantly turning it off and on again. No questions so far. Okay, then, how do we build a hash function from that building block? So first of all, let's assume that our message M is, as we said at the beginning, a string of L bits. So a reminder, L is the number of bits of M. Then the first thing that we do is we pad our message. So we slightly extend our message with a so-called padding. So M prime is basically M1. To ML. And then we concatenate this with 1 and then many zeros and finally L, with the goal that the length of this entire message is L times N where L is the number of blocks of M prime. Now we rewrite this message as M star 1 to M star L, such that the length of every block MI star equals N. So what we did is we had our message, this message has a number of bits, then we extend our message with 1, a couple of zeros, and then L, and the goal is that this padded, this extended message now has a length that is divisible by the block length. So we remember n is the number of bits of each of the inputs as well as of the output. And then we just rewrite that message to just consider the blocks such that every block has length n. Easy. Okay, and now we write down the Merkle-Damgaard construction. So we start with the very first message, or message block, m1 star, and with a so-called initialization vector. These two values are input to our compression function, and then we use our compression function to forward the output of the first compression function, take it as input to the second compression function, and we take as input to the second compression function also the second block of the message. We continue to do so until we observe absorbed all of our blocks. And combine them in our compression function with the output of the previous compression function. This is the Merkle-Damgaard construction. Today, at the very beginning of this course, we still stay rather informal. We don't have a proof. But if you're interested in the proof, you can take a look at the Katz-Lindell book. So basically, all of the constructions, all of the building blocks that we see in this course, have full proofs in the Katz-Lindell book, and you can take a look, and it's really interesting if you're interested in that. What is relevant to mention here is that this Merkle-Damgaard construction is the principle, the basic principle behind many real-world hash functions. So it's the basic principle of MD5. That's the reason why it's called MD. Of SHA-1. And of SHA-2. Problem is, and that's the reason why I cross those two first hash functions out, we don't want to use them anymore because we have known collision attacks. Any questions about the Merkle-Damgaard construction? Yes, please.
The equations above the graphic. You used n and l as variables.
Yes.
So l is the length of the original message, right? Or
so. Lowercase l is the length, the bit length of the original message. Right. Capital L is the number of blocks that we can split the padded message in when n is the block length.
Okay, n is the length of single, like the number of bits in a single block.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah, if we look a little bit further up, we see that our compression function takes as input length 2 times n bit strings, and it outputs bit strings of length n. So basically, each of the inputs has length n, as well as the output also has length n.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, whenever I write these things here, this means bit length.
Okay.
There might be exceptions, I'm not sure, but I think typically I specify lengths in bits. Further questions? Yes, please.
So the message is always added to the next multiple of n?
Not necessarily. The important part is that the padding always includes the length of the original message, and it at least includes 1 0 and 1 1 and 2 zeros. So if you do that for the first time and you again go over the next block length, you will just pad such that you fill the next block length. So this here might be, like this message might be 2 blocks shorter than this padded message. But it can also just be 1 block. It depends on, so this is these are the necessary components of the padding, and if you can fit that into the current block length, then you're happy. But if you exceed the current block length, you will just add more zeros here. Further questions? Yes.
So the last block is the binary description of number L.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Important to say. Okay. Then a more modern version of how to build a hash function is the so-called sponge construction. And it was introduced by Bertoni et al. At a workshop in 2007. And the basic idea is as follows. So we start with a bit string, and this bit string is again specified as the so-called initialization vector. So just, this is also another thing that I want to mention. The initialization vector is fixed for every hash function. So there is in the standard, there is written, this is the initialization vector for MD5 or for SHA-1 or whatever. This is just the fixed bit string that somebody came up with and thought this is a good idea. The process of specifying such an initialization vector is slightly more complicated, but it's basically just a constant bit string. Give myself a little bit more space. Then, this initialization vector is split into two parts. The first part is XORed with parts of the message. And for this, we again take the message and pad it with 0, 1, 1, 0, a couple of further zeros, and a 1, such that again this fits into the block length. And the block length in this case is the length of this first half of the input of the function f, for which we just say in a second what it is. So F is a so-called random permutation. So again, we basically blockwise process the inputs, XOR them before we feed them into the random permutation, and then we again represent the output as two halves of a bit string that for which then the first part is again XORed. First with the input of a block of a message, and this is again input to the next random permutation. This first part here in which we have the input of the message is called the so-called absorb phase. So we basically, if you consider a sponge, you first let the sponge soak all everything around it into the core of the sponge. And then after all of the inputs are absorbed, we first of all take the first half of the output as the hash value, but we can continue with these operations. So we basically, again, take the random permutation, produce some output, take the random permutation, produce some output. And then if we do that, this entire second phase is called the squeeze phase. So we basically push the sponge, get the output, and the longer we squeeze, the more output we get. But if we only need a little bit of output, so just the constant size hash value, then we only need to squeeze maybe once or twice. But there are situations in which we want to have more output. For example, if we want to have a key derivation of multiple keys, then squeezing a lot of output from that function can be relevant. This is again just the basic principle that I present here, and it is actually the basic principle of SHA-3. Any questions about that? We won't go very much in, no, we won't go in any further details of that. This is relevant enough for the exam, but we can still discuss interested about that. Yeah?
Just one question, and then the
Yeah, then double pipe. Yeah.
Double pipe means that, does that mean concatenation?
Yes.
So you add this, the next bit.
Yes, exactly.
How long?
So what I concatenate here is 0, 1, 1, 0, and then a variable length of further zeros, and then at the end 1, 0, and 1, 1 again, such that I will fit into the block size. And the block size in this case, sorry?
The initial vector of this, what's the block size?
Ah, yeah, this depends on the concrete sponge. So if you, we would need to look up what SHA-3 has. But the block size is the length of this first half of this block here. Yeah, and then it depends on the sponge that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple applications of such sponges, but SHA-3 is one, but there are also block ciphers, so encryption schemes that are based on these sponges. Okay, yes, please. Not necessarily. Again, this depends on the concrete sponge that you're looking at. And so if you look in the book, I believe that it splits the IV into some part that is L and then the other part that is the rest. So, of course, this is again variable. It's just I just wanted to give you an idea of the concept, but I think that at least Christoph Paar and Jan Pelzel and Tim Ginesu have a concrete have concrete numbers for both the block size and the splitting of the inputs of the random permutation and so on, and also probably tell you what type of random permutation is used. Okay, then finally, something that is used in proofs to make our lives easier, which is the so-called random oracle model. So you've heard me complaining about the problems of defining security for hash functions. And I would say the majority of papers that take hash functions as building blocks, these hash functions are not used by using their collision resistance, but rather they are modeled as so-called random oracles. So, what is a random oracle? The random oracle model is an idealized model of hash functions. And the properties that we idealize is that, first of all, the outputs look random. And an output is only known after processing the input. As I just said a couple of seconds ago, the purpose of using the so-called random oracle model is that, bless you, collision resistance is not always easy to use in proofs. So how do we instantiate the random oracle model? We consider the random oracle to look as follows. It takes as input a message. Then internally, we have some array. That may store some value for some input m. And if this input is not defined yet, which is denoted by this bot symbol or this whatever inverted t symbol, we basically sample a fresh value from the output space. So the output space of our hash function is bit strings of length n. And so if our oracle internally has not sampled such a value for the input m yet, it will sample that value. And then at the end, it will assign this value to the output. So, I introduced this without having talked about proofs yet, without having talked about any type of constructions or any type of attackers. Our idea is that instead of considering real hash functions like SHA-2, SHA-3, or whatever, we just assume that whenever a big protocol uses a hash function, it will not execute a real hash algorithm. But it will ask somebody in the sky and ask, hey, I would like to have the hash value of m. And then internally, something like that is executed in the sky and the caller gets back the hash value. And so whenever I as the attacker want to know what will be the hash value of my message m, also, the attacker has to ask the oracle that sits somewhere just directly next to God, and I will ask that oracle, what is the hash value of that message? I will get back the hash value. And that's the point where we have the idealization. So this is nothing that is practical. This is nothing that works in practice. But we assume for the moment in our proof that hash values, hash functions give us these properties. That actually we cannot predict the output of a hash function if we have not called the hash function. And the values that are output by a hash function, they look random. So as I said, this is an idealization. This is not a real form of a hash function. But we will see in proofs, if we want to prove security of something that uses a hash function, it makes our life much easier if we do not assume that a real hash function is used by an algorithm, or that this hash function is executed and evaluated locally by the attacker. We just ask everybody, both the algorithms, the attackers, the users, that whenever they want to know what the hash value of some message m is, they will just call the random oracle in the sky and ask, what is the hash value for that? So this is an idealized model. Important is, this is not a real assumption. Because we cannot instantiate it. It can never be true that we have something like a random oracle. More concretely, if we ask, or if we invoke, execute the SHA-2 hash functions with the code of SHA-2, then there will be a hash value for that, in whatever language we consider it to be. The problem is that if we want to call the random oracle on the description of the random oracle, there is no form of specifying that, because there is no compact specification of the random oracle. The idea is that the random oracle existed since forever and it will exist forever. There is no randomness in here, and all of this must be in principle pre-programmed. A hash function is a function that has no randomness in it. The only reason why we have randomness in here is that we want to have a compact description of our idealization. In practice, we can't have that, because at the very first time at which the random oracle would have been queried on a fixed message, this message would have been fixed and it would have stayed there forever. And for that reason, the description of the random oracle would grow infinitely if we allow for infinitely long messages. So there is no compact specification, no compact description of the random oracle. And it is actually a problem. Yes, please? Cannot be instantiated. Instantiated. Yes, you're welcome. Thanks for asking. So there are more or less artificial examples that cause problems. So concretely, there are security proofs for somewhat artificial constructions for which the proof used the random oracle. So instead of proving something with collision resistance, the proof used a random oracle instead of a hash function. And then when we instantiate the construction in practice and use a hash function instead, then there are attacks against that construction. So normally, and that's the heuristic, that's the approach of our theory, normally when we use the random oracle to prove something, it typically translates to practice. So it typically means that when we use the same construction with a hash function, everything is fine. Exactly the things that we proved should also work in a world in which we use hash functions. But there are some more or less artificial examples for which when we proved something in the random oracle, this does not translate to practice. So then we actually have attacks. So far, these artificial examples are still artificial enough to work with the random oracle in our proofs. And we will maybe have situations later in the course in which we use the random oracle to see how handy and simple it is instead of collision resistance. So, real, non-artificial use. So there are a couple of parentheses and a couple of quotation marks. So far, mostly fine. A little bit hand-wavy. But it's okay. Okay. So this was probably the most informal chapter of this lecture. This was about hash functions. The next chapter will be about key derivation functions, but first a question. So, whenever I,
feed it with the same m,
yeah,
the same value
Yes, yes. So I make sure that this is the case, that by having that whenever a message is first queried here, this value here, so no value is assigned to h of m. So I first check if h of m is not defined. If it is not defined, then I define it by sampling a random value of the output space. And then if this case here was never or has not been the case, then I know that already I have assigned something to h of m, and so I will just output the hash value. So for every proof, my random oracle is deterministic in the sense that it will always output the same output hash for the same message. But for every proof, of course, the random oracle is instantiated freshly. So in a global sense, all the proofs use different random oracles. Yeah. Does that answer the question sufficiently? OK, perfect.
Basically, you have a huge database for all hashes?
Yes. Yes.
And the purpose of storing the calculated value of the hash is that we can output it again, right?
Yes.
So because it's random.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. And you can think of the advantages of using the random oracle as follows. So at the end, if we think that the random oracle sits in the sky right next to God, then we can think that actually it doesn't make a difference if I can observe what happens in that random oracle, if everybody can observe what happens in the random oracle. And so later in our proofs, it gives us, as the provers, a big advantage of seeing what everybody was querying to the random oracle. For normal hash functions, we can't do that. But for a random oracle for which we are the ones who prove things, we can observe all the inputs, we can observe all the outputs. And if we make it even trickier, we, as the provers, as the reductions, we can actually program the output of the random oracle in a somewhat sophisticated manner. Those are the advantages. We will use them much, much later in the course. But that was just the first primer of what the random oracle is. And it's, as I said, just an idealization. So whenever you want to build something in practice, you can't say, ah, I thought the random oracle model has pretty good properties. Yes, it has. It does. But only for proofs. If you want to build something really, you need to use something based on sponges or Merkle-Damgaard constructions or other types of real hash functions. Okay, further questions about hash functions and their idealizations? If not, we will continue now with key derivations or key derivation functions. So the big problem that we have in practice when we want to start with cryptography is we want to get secrecy. We want to get randomness. We want to get something that only we know and nobody else knows. And one source of such randomness and secrecy is sometimes or typically a password. So our goal is to derive some key from a password. And then maybe we want to derive further keys from such key to, for example, have a key for authentication or a key for encryption. Those are the purposes, the goals that we target with building something like a key derivation function. So we have somewhat unstructured input with unstructured randomness and secrecy. And we want to derive something from that that gives us strong guarantees. And the strong guarantees that we want to have is that these keys, they look random from the first to the last bit. So just purely random strings that are indistinguishable from a string that I just sampled uniformly at random. So what are the problems with passwords? What are the problems with passwords? Maybe collect some, like two small problems with passwords. Yes, please.
They come from a fairly limited key space.
Okay.
Only common letters, for example, word combinations, leave the bank, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that already suffices, probably. So the problems are, first of all, that passwords typically have arbitrary lengths. For example, some people just use sentences with very low entropy, so they are too long. Some use just very short passwords that are much shorter than a key. But maybe they use enough exclamation marks to fit the password policies, and so there is a lot of entropy in there. So they are too short. Another problem is that maybe I want to know, we had the key space, that's maybe sufficient. So another problem is the encoding. For example, ASCII. So for example, in ASCII, we have the problem that one bit of every character is already fixed. So typically, we just use A to Z, lowercase letters and capital letters, maybe some numbers, maybe some special symbols. But typically, the first symbol is just fixed to 0 in ASCII. So probably at least one bit is fixed. So we now live in a world where we just assume that passwords offer enough entropy, but the problem is that the entropy is very weirdly distributed. So it can be in a very, very long phrase of a password, but just looking at the bits, there are patterns. There are bad patterns that we don't want to have for cryptography. And so the goal that we have for our key derivation functions is that we can extract entropy from the source. And the source here is the password, but it can also be just unstructured randomness from our machine. So if we have a key derivation function that should produce us some randomness from, I don't know, the temperature of our machine and the memory accesses, or I don't know, the calculations on the processing unit and so on and so forth. There are some things that are predictable, there are patterns in that, and still there is some entropy. And so we want to extract this entropy and turn it into a random looking string. So more concretely, we want to derive keys from the source maintaining the entropy. So again, we start with our syntax. The syntax is taken from a research paper, but it is very established in the literature. And we now, so it's already the second session, we take one step towards abstraction. And instead of using bit strings, we now use abstract spaces. So the first space that we consider to be the input of a key derivation function is the so-called source of secret randomness. So we call SR the source of secret randomness. The second input that we take is some public seed. The third input is some associated data. And lastly, we take as input or associated data or context. And the last input that we take is the output length. And this all results deterministically in a key. So the notation here is that we have a function name, and that's the function key derivation function. And then we have the sets of inputs, and then we have the set of the output. We can slightly extend that syntax for special purposes. By saying that a key derivation function consists of two faces. First, an extract function that takes as input the source of secret randomness as well as the public seed, and it outputs a state. So a secret state is the output. And then we have a key derivation function expand function. And that expand function takes the state, associated data, and the output length, and then outputs keys. So this is just a generalization of what we have seen a couple of seconds ago. We just split the extraction of randomness. So we have unstructured input material, like a password or the heat of my computer or the memory access patterns or whatever. These are the sources of secret randomness. We have some public seed, like my context, like my application name, the application name in which I want to extract randomness. Or, I don't know, maybe I have a hash function and I have a seed for that that I always use. And all of that is extracted first, collected, put into a state, and then whenever I want to obtain randomness, I use that state and give that state some context. For example, I don't know, again, this is my today's use of TLS for my session with Wikipedia, so give me a good secret or good randomness for that particular session. And that means that whenever I change the context, I want to have an independent key. And I also say how long my key should look like. So maybe I need 512 bits, maybe I need 128 bits. And so this is what is specified in this final input. And then I get an output. So for defining the security of a random of a key derivation function, we first define so-called min entropy. So min entropy, some of you may have seen that definition already. You don't have to understand it in the first round of reading it. I will have an explanation in a second. So a probabilistic distribution X has n bits of min entropy, if for every fixed value x, it holds that the probability that some capital X X equals the lowercase x when the capital X is sampled from the distribution X is less equal 1 over 2 to the n. So first write that down, and then we will think about the meaning of that. Okay. Yes, please.
What is the meaning of this second symbol? X equals small s, depends.
So I think I will just read out the entire definition. Yes. The definition is min entropy. A probabilistic distribution, calligraphic X, large calligraphic X, has n bits of min entropy if for every fixed value lowercase x, it holds that the probability of some capital X equals lowercase x, where the capital X is sampled from the distribution calligraphic capital X. And this probability should be less equal 1 over 2 to the n. I promise you, next week everything will be nicer. This is just the dry foundation. Okay, so what is the meaning of that? The meaning is the most likely element of the distribution is sampled with probability at most 1 over 2 to the n. So, for example, we have a distribution of passwords. We look at the list of passwords that are used under a certain password policy, and then we basically have a large list of users who use different passwords, then the min entropy says that the password that is most likely chosen still has a probability of being chosen at most with probability 1 over 2 to the n. This is what min entropy says. So it basically says that we have at least n bits of entropy in the worst password that we can think of. Does that make sense, or are there questions? It's basically the minimal entropy that we can sample from that distribution. Okay, so this was a quick interception, quick definition of min entropy. So what do we want to do with that? We want to specify the security of our key derivation functions. Given a source SR, with min entropy n, it is hard to distinguish output k in the space of output keys from a key k prime that is sampled uniformly at random from that output space. So if we look back at our definition of the syntax, the only source of randomness, the only source of secret randomness that we have is this SR space. This is the distribution, this is the space of possible inputs that the attacker does not know. And so if we have such a source that offers us min entropy n, so at least n bits of randomness, then we want that the output of a key derivation function that maps to the key space k, this output should be indistinguishable from a randomly sampled output. Coming back to practice, if we have a function and we seed it with one of the passwords from our long list of passwords, for which we know that every password, even the worst one, still offers some entropy, then we want that if we feed that password into our key derivation function and we obtain an output key, then this key should just look the same, more or less, should just be indistinguishable from a key that I just sample uniformly at random from a key. So these keys, the real key output from the key derivation function, and the key that I just sample without any inputs, without any function, just sampling it uniformly at random, these two keys should look indistinguishable. So if we have an attacker, we can consider the following experiment. We give the attacker either a random key, or we give the adversary a key that is output from a key derivation function for which the attacker does not know which element from the input source of secret randomness I chose, then it should be hard for the attacker to say, okay, this was a real key, or no, this was a random key. This is the idea of the definition of security for a key derivation function. Questions? No questions, good. Then, quick typical shortcut. We typically model key derivation functions as pseudo random functions. And we will look at pseudo random functions next week. So, now finally, a quick idea of how one of the most used, one of the most prominent, one of the most important key derivation functions look like. So we look at the so-called HKDF, which is HMAC-based. And the HKDF was defined by Hugo Krawczyk. And published at Crypto 2010. And it is also standardized in RFC 5869. So typically, or in the literature, the HKDF is called hash-based key derivation function or HMAC-based key derivation function. But the inventor is Hugo Krawczyk, whose initials are HK. So it's basically the Hugo Krawczyk derivation function. That's a way to remember it. And the KDF or the HKDF consists of, just as we've described it earlier, two subfunctions, the extract function. And the extract function takes as input some source of randomness, some concrete source of randomness that is taken from the space of source of randomness, and some public seed. And it is defined as the HMAC that takes the same inputs, but the other way around. So in the reversed order. I will talk about HMACs in roughly 4 weeks. So this first extraction here is used as a randomness extractor and randomness extractors are outside the scope of this lecture. The second function, the expand function, takes as input the state, some associated data, and the output length. And it works as follows. It first of all sets the output key to an empty string. And then it sets the running variable, the counter I, to 0. And then, while the length of the output key is less than the desired output length, we execute and concatenate the key. With the output of the HMAC, on input the state, and the concatenation of the associated data, and the running variable I. And in this case, the HMAC is used as a pseudorandom function. As I said, we will look at pseudorandom functions next week. Then the counter is just incremented, and at the end, we return the key bits of the first L bits of the key. First L bits of the key, full stop. So, as I said, we will talk about the HMAC and length a little bit later in the course, but just to give you an idea of what the HMAC looks like, so the HMAC stands for hash-based message authentication code. And the reason for this is that it really just only is based on hash functions. So it takes first the hash function on input of the key that is XORed with some value OPAD. This value is then concatenated with the hash value of another hash function of another input k XORed with some second value iPad, and this second input value is then also concatenated with the actual input message m, and that's the specification. OPAD and iPad are different paddings. And more about in roughly 4 weeks. Yes.
In the first line of the experiment, what is assigned to the K?
An empty string. So basically nothing. It's
what
just
is the letter E.
No, this is epsilon, which is typically used. Yeah. There are two versions of epsilon. The one is element of, and then the other is this curly E.
Yeah.
Smaller case, yeah. Pretty dark in here. No, this probably won't help you. So, are there any questions about anything that we talked about today? There were fewer questions in the second half than in the first half. Anything. No questions. Then I have nothing to add today. I will see you next week. Enjoy reading the documentations of the Double Ratchet and the TLS protocol. You don't have to go into very deep details. It's just about making yourself familiar of what roughly the idea is and what the building blocks are. And thank you very much for being here, and I see you next week.